is Gilbert Gottfried, and I'm here with my co-host, Frank Santopadre, and we're once again at Nutmeg with our engineer, Frank Verderosa, and this is Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Obsessions, and we're here with part two with our guest. Let's see if I have it right. Gary Gerani.
Colossal Obsessions.
Yeah,
thank you, right. Gabby Gottfried.
That was nicely done. Right.
He called you Gabby Gerani.
I'm
last
very
week.
Gabby anyway, so yeah. that was appropriate.
Yeah. A lot of times it's a tribute to classic Westerns. Name.
Some people say Gary Gerani or now, Jerry Gerani. The hard C and the soft G just is a problem.
Now as a leftover, because we were talking about where dicks pop up in... In
what a beautiful way to open this
movie
one.
Ads and cartoons and Star Wars. I think in Teen Wolf, there's a scene in the gym, and one guy in the background, one of the extras, pulled his dick out, and it stayed in the movie.
In which?
In Teen Wolf.
In Teen Wolf.
Yeah. A guy pulled his dick out and was holding his dick.
Well, there is a reason why the dick angle is being mentioned, of course, because it does...
Hi, I'm Dick Angle.
And his sidekick, Gabby Gerani.
I'm assuming we're connecting it to the famous C-3PO having an erection training.
Yes, if you missed last week's episode, I love to say that, you missed a scintillating conversation about the famous Star Wars, the infamous Star Wars erection card that Gary worked on, because Gary is the king of trading cards. He is the card king. I'm doing a little recap.
That's true.
And bringing them up to speed.
This works.
And last week we talked about your time at Topps, a little bit about the history of Topps. We could have gotten into so much more.
Oh, yes.
But it's hard to cover in 28 minutes. And Gilbert... Gilbert went completely off the reservation and wants to know where religious comic books that were handed out on the street come.
Right, which is one thing I couldn't help him with, but sounds great.
But we'll throw it out there again in case you weren't listening to episode one.
Oh,
just tell them what you're looking for. You want to know.
Okay. Because I know, Pendulette knew the name of it, and I think he even knew the guy. They used to hand out these comic books, rectangular little comic books out on the street, and it was from some church group.
What era are we talking about here? The 70s, 60s?
I was a little kid. I must have been the 60s.
50s, 60s. Okay.
Well, I can email Len Brown tonight.
He'll know. How is Len? Would you give him my best?
Oh, I will indeed.
Please. I haven't seen him in ages.
Len's great. I mean, Len, he was like my big brother at Topps, and we were great pals, and we both loved horror, sci-fi, and all that. We always tried to push Topps into doing things. I remember we desperately wanted them to do a Wonder Woman card set when it came out, the Linda Carter show, because we had the hots for Linda Carter.
Sure.
Oh, it'd be great to
do that.
Why
not?
And that didn't quite work out. We wound up eventually doing The Incredible Hulk, which was okay, you know.
Wasn't there a problem with the Hulk? Like, they didn't have the...
Funny you should mention that. It was very much like last week when I was talking about... We were talking about the Batman trading cards.
Right.
Originally, same thing. Lou Ferrigno and Bill Bixby did not want to give the rights to their images to, you know, so people who had an Incredible Hulk license just went to the drawings and paintings and whatever. So we were going to paint a series of the Hulk. As a matter of fact, Norm Saunders, who painted the original Batman cards.
Sure,
and
we talked about the great Norm Saunders.
He was actually on staff in the art department at Topps at that time. And I went over to him and I said, you know, we have this just like the Batman thing again. Do you think you could try doing a Hulk thing, maybe having him picking up a car or something? And he said, Gary, please don't ask me to do it. I really don't have it anymore. I really can't do
that. Wow.
And I said, but please, please, please. And then he did do it. And he was right. It wasn't bad, but it was not.
That's a shame.
You know.
I so admired his talent.
He was brilliant.
Yeah.
By the way, we did then get the rights with the
Hulk cards. I remember the Hulk cards.
Yeah. That was actually not a bad set.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of great shots from the pilot where the Hulk's makeup was more monstrous. The head was more Neanderthal.
In the 90s, we did so many things there that never happened, like I told you. The weird wheels, and we did... Drew did this wonderful series called Ugly Americans that never happened. And
because the success of Garbage Pail Kids kids.
Yes.
You know, so, okay, what else can we do that's subversive and crazy and whatever?
Well, the grossology books were,
right.
That was the order
of the
day.
I mean, what's interesting is I handle most of the movie and TV tie-ins, also creating new products and even candy products. Not only, I remember I created something called Drac Snacks, which were like shaped candies like vampires in coffins, and then Leapin' Lizards, which were dinosaurs, and we'd have little candies shaped like these things, and I would design and draw the little candy shapes. So if you worked there, no matter what your area of expertise was, and again, movie TV was mine, but they would hit you with anything.
Oh, yeah.
Say, try this, see what you could get out of this, you know, and that's how I wound up doing one of the prototypes for GPK.
Those brainstorming meetings were very weird.
Yes.
Yeah.
But wonderful personalities.
But wonderful, wonderful. What were you going to ask, Gil?
Now, this, I always like to get it away from the topic we're talking about.
That's fine.
Now,
Bill your comment
Bixby,
on the Civil War. That was a hell of a shame.
and Topps did a great painted
Topps
card
series. Topps did a Civil War card series.
It always
Look
leads
at that.
Back to Topps.
Segway.
Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno didn't get along.
That's what they say. That's what they say.
Well, you know, Lou Ferrigno was a guy from the neighborhood. He wasn't a Hollywood guy. He was, you know, like a Goomba, one of these guys, one of my type of fellas that I know him.
Bixby was a bright guy.
And Bill Bixby was pure Hollywood, you know, very slick, very nice guy, but a friendly guy. And I think Lou just didn't know how to handle it. Hey, listen, Burt Ward had the same problem when he did. He used to fight with Adam West all the time.
Right.
I guess these guys...
They got paid for their likenesses ultimately, right? Using these cards. I mean, because they were holding out.
Yeah.
We talked about Heston, too. The Planet of the Apes cards. Heston wouldn't give his... we didn't tell that last time.
Yeah. Charlton Heston limited the amount of cards. There was like a proportion of the number of cards he would be in the set. So we couldn't make that original set a particularly big card set. I think it was only like 44 cards because we didn't want him to have so many cards without Heston. Of course, I say we. That was 69. I started in 72. I was like you. I was buying them on the candy counter.
Yes.
And here's how it worked. You go in the candy store. You would look at the racks. I'd look for my famous Monsters magazine. Then my eyes would drift to the comics. And the last thing would be you'd look at the candy counter to see if there was a new trading card set.
Oh, those days.
And lo and behold, there was the plastic. Oh, yes.
The spinner rack days. Yeah.
Everything was so special back then.
I know.
Because you didn't have everything
time
coming out of your
come
ears
again.
The way we have now. You know?
Yeah. Let's talk about Outer Limits, too, because Gil and Twilight Zone, because you are, and plug what's coming out.
Yeah, Kino Lorber just released a beautiful Blu-ray set on The Outer Limits, season one, that doing season two very shortly. And what they did is they got in touch with me to do some commentaries on some of the classic episodes. Because I had written a book in 1976 called Fantastic Television, which was the very, very first book to deal with science fiction, fantasy,
a wonderful
horror.
Book that I had, and I don't know what happened to my copy, but I'm happy to see that I can still get one on Amazon.
Yes,
so I'm going to get it.
They are. I mean, my God, it's incredibly
Fantastic
dated
television.
By today's standards.
That's fine. I had a lot of fondness for that book.
But it really was the first book to deal with a Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits and all these things and listing all the episodes and discussing them. And there was no way you could track those, you know, you couldn't, there were no books on this subject. That really, you know, I was very, very happy to be the guy that brought that out. And because of that, I've been asked to do commentaries on The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits and the Boris Karloff thriller series. And I've seen these things over and over and know a lot about them. So I was very happy to do them. But The Outer Limits, it's great. They're from beautiful prints.
They look good.
They've never looked better, you know, in their life. And The Outer Limits was a show that, the first season especially, most of the episodes were shot by Conrad Hall.
Wow.
Was one of the greatest cinematographers.
Conrad Hall. Sure.
Whoever, you know, Oscar-winning.
Of course.
Incredible. In Cold Blood. I mean, go down to
the American Beauty.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. And if you look at that show, the ones that he shot, it's like motion picture photography. It looks like Orson Welles' German Expressionism.
I was even looking
Fantastic.
At them on YouTube today, and I was even in that shitty format, I was surprised at how good they look.
Yeah, especially the Hall ones. He did about, you know, more than a third of them in the first season, almost a half of them. And they're really brilliant looking.
Then I remember, well, it's just like Twilight Zone. Every 10 years or so, they bring back the old new Twilight Zone.
They try to do it. They keep trying to do it. Yeah, rebooted Outer Limits.
They did a reboot on Outer Limits
as
well.
Oh, yeah, on Showtime.
Sure.
They were terrible.
Sure they did.
Yeah. Yeah,
they weren't good.
You know, I mean, these are brand names. Everybody knows the Twilight Zone, even the Outer Limits, which only the original show only lasted a season and a half back in the day, whereas at least Twilight Zone went to about five seasons.
Of course.
But the names resonate. So, yeah, the
And all those great actors are on there, too. A lot of the great actors that you see on the Twilight Zone show up in the Outer Limits.
Yeah, because it was from the same acting pool of the great people who like Cliff Robertson.
Martin Landau.
Yeah, right.
Robert Culp, of course, is in the two
episodes. So you kept getting those good actors.
Yeah, he was in that one where he's an alien who takes a human form, and he's at a boarding house, Martin Landau.
Yes.
And I did
a commentary on that. It was The Man Who Was Never Born.
Yes.
That's an excellent episode. Shot by Conrad Hall.
Yes.
That's a beautiful one.
In his room, and he switches back to his alien-looking self, and the landlady, the door is accidentally open, and the landlady sees him and screams, and then he turns quickly back into Martin Landau, and she goes, "Oh, I thought I saw a horrible monster, unless you're not what I think you are." And he goes, "Few of us are, Miss McCluskey."
Yes, and you
very
got the
good.
Name. Very good. Very
Landau's
good.
In another one. He's in one with Neil Hamilton from Batman.
Yes, that is the Bellarrow Shield.
The Bellarrow Shield, right.
Now, you know, most of the actors, when they would appear a couple of times, okay, I want to be a monster in one, and I want to look like a normal person in the other. Well, Man Who Was Never Born, he could do both in the same episode. And what that was is he was a mutated human from the future who is going back into time to stop what caused the world to turn into mutants. And, of course, James Cameron kind of borrowed that idea along with some of Harlan Ellison's evidence
for
the Terminator.
Yes, he
and,
did.
As I'm doing commentaries, I'm saying, yeah, well, here we see the seeds of that.
A lot of those Zone episodes and Outer Limits episodes were borrowed and turned
into so influential
feature stories.
Yeah. There was that kind of a famous Outer Limits where they had one story written and they built a monster alien suit for some guy and he fell down while he was filming it and it broke the suit and they didn't have money to build a new suit. So they had to change the entire story. And I think they put in a gunshot when the actor falls down.
It was strange. Sometimes Outer Limits would, on occasion, for the episode The Human Factor, which had Sally Kellerman and Gary Merrill. They were a romantic team. It was like a love story between Gary Merrill and a young Sally Kellerman. Just picture that, which is pretty out there.
I remember Sally Kellerman turned up a couple of times.
Just yesterday, I saw an old Bonanza, as opposed to the new Bonanzas coming out.
You're up for the Hop Sing in the new one, aren't you?
Hop Sing.
Yeah. Hop Gilbert's Sing. Bringing Hop Sing back.
Be politically correct by today's standards.
Yes.
And in this one, Hoss has a beautiful girl who's in love with him. And it's Sally Kellerman.
She got around.
Yeah.
She was a working actor. She also appears in the Star Trek, the second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before.
That's right.
So she was no stranger to that. And, you know, in The Outer Limits, she did two of them. She did the one with Gary Merrill. The reason I mentioned the Gary Merrill is that they created this incredible ice creature monster for that, which they didn't wind up using. It became the front man on our trading card set. Because it was a great-looking monster, and they released the photos, but they cut it.
There was an Outer Limits trading card set too.
Yes,
but I did not know that existed.
What was exciting about that is that Topps hand-colored really did a great job of colorization.
Wow.
Of all those black and white monsters, so it was kind of fun to see.
Oh man,
them in color.
Get my hands on those.
And what was the Outer Limits with Robert Culp?
Well, there were two.
No,
right?
There were three.
Three? Well, I only know Architects of Fear and, of course, Harlan's episode, the Demon with the Glass Hand.
He did three of them. And you mentioned Architects of Fear. That's another one I did a commentary
for. That is a good one.
And I'm very proud to have done that. That's one of the – that's when he's a scientist and they're going to turn him into an alien and pretend that he's coming to scare the people of Earth into becoming peaceful.
Right.
He's going to show up at the UN and
it's a Serling kind of story almost because it's got
except
political.
It went the traditional Outer Limits route, which was a little different than Twilight Zone would always build to the twist ending and they were like these little parables and moral stories, whereas Outer Limits sometimes would just be like weird. You know, they throw a monster at you, and the storylines would be a little hard to grasp. As a kid, it was much easier to understand the moral of the story in Twilight Zone. With Outer Limits, you were just usually grooving on the monsters.
I only know those two. I know the Demon with a Glass Hand, of course, which people consider to be...
Yes, and here's the quickie on that. Architects of Fear was the first one that he did, and that was, I think, the third episode shown on The Outer Limits. It was a very important episode. The next one he did was also for season one, called Corpus Earthling, and you've got to see that show. First of all, we're talking about Conrad Hall's cinematography. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. He finds angles I never knew existed in that show. It's a brilliantly shot show. Very simple premise. He's got a metal plate in his head, and that enables him to hear these two rocks that are talking about taking over the Earth.
Do you know this one, Gil?
No.
This is amazing. You have to see it. It's a cult favorite among Outer Limits fans because it's very, very nightmarish, much scarier than usual. So he's in that. He loses his girlfriend, played by Salome Jens, who was another actress who got around a lot during that. It was one of his girlfriends at the time. And but she was a good actress. And very, very scary episode.
What's it called again?
It's called Corpus Earthling, because these Corpus rocks Earthling. Invade the bodies of humans, and they turn them into... Do you ever see the movie Carnival of Souls?
Sure, of course.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we've talked
about
it on this show.
Well, the people that the rocks take over look like those zombies. So it was terrifying. And the way Hall shot it, brilliant. And then the third cult episode he did for season two, which is Demon with a Glass Hand.
Right, that's the Harlan Ellison.
Which, yeah, many people consider, you know, among the best, you know, in the series. And it's great. All three episodes are terrific.
And we will return to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast after this.
And the one that always, well, this is the one they use whenever they talk about The Outer Limits, they show this. And that was the one with Ilya Kuryakin.
Yes, yes. the sixth finger.
Oh, the sixth finger.
Yes.
We were talking about it before with David McCallum.
With Edward Mulhare.
Edward Mulhare from The Ghost and Mrs. Muir.
Edward Mulhare.
He's the scientist.
Edward Mulhare was pretty much the substitute Rex Harrison his whole career.
That's interesting.
Yeah, he took over for Rex Harrison, I think, on Broadway or something for My Fair Lady. And whenever you needed someone to do, that's why he wound up on The Ghost, because Rex Harrison played that role in the movie in 1947.
Yeah, very much like him.
But David McCallum, who did two Outer Limits, he did The Sixth Finger, where his head gets bigger and bigger and bigger. He's the man of the future. They're mutating him.
And,
right. That's a classic episode. And then he did the last episode of season one, which is called The Forms of Things Unknown, which if you haven't seen this again, Conrad Hall being crazy with the cinematography, that episode was done to sort of emulate the look of foreign movies, is like these two women are killing their lover, and then they wind up running into David McCallum, who's a madman who has tilted time and brought himself back to life. It is brilliant.
David McCallum's still around. We got to get him on the show.
Oh, yes.
So much to talk about if we can track David
McCallum
down.
And they filmed that episode twice, to be an episode of The Outer Limits and also to stand alone as a pilot for a series that Joe Stefano, who was the producer on Outer Limits, who wrote Psycho and all that, so we brought that old dark house feeling to everything. He was trying to launch another series at the end of the run of Outer Limits called The Unknown. So he has one version of that story where McCallum's character just thinks he's come back to life in conquered time, and in the other one, he really has. So there were slightly different scenes, all shot by Hall, all brilliant.
And
we're trying to get that pilot, that second one, The Unknown, on the second season release, even though it was done for the first, because that no one has really seen it in that form.
I gotta get this box set.
Blu-ray
set.
Because some people
great.
Have said, "Gee, I have the old Blu-rays. Aren't they good enough?" No.
Okay.
No, these. Okay. The quality is better. Plus, you get our exciting commentaries.
Sold, sir. Tell us about the Twilight Zone commentaries you did.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about Walking Distance, too, with Kig Young, Gilbert's favorite, before we turned the mics on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also got that actor in it, Frank Overton.
Oh, Frank Overton.
Who plays his
Frank
father.
Overton. Frank Overton is
you
great.
You name one other podcast in the world, buddy, that's talking about Frank Overton.
I have a friend
this is
who
it.
Likes
Name and other any other human being on the planet.
Or Max Showalter.
Yeah. Another great. With his other name, too, Casey Adams.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
We got it. In the monster that challenged the world, he's Casey Adams.
Absolutely.
By the time he does 10, he's Max Showalter. But Frank Overton Frank Overton's probably most famous role, I guess. He's in To Kill a Mockingbird. He's the sheriff. He's the one who says, you know, right at the end, that let's not take Robert Duvall in. Let him, he killed a bad guy. Let it just stay that way. That's probably his most important part. But he turned up in all these things. And he was in a few Twilight Zones. He even did one of the Hour episodes that they're showing now on MeTV, with the episode Mute, where there's a little girl who seems to be mute, but basically she's been tutored in psychic stuff, so she doesn't talk. They don't realize this is a fire and her parents are killed. Yeah. And Frank Overton adopts her or takes her in and is trying to figure out what is it with this girl.
Yeah, that, and he goes, this is his childhood, Martin.
Yeah,
you can't share it with him.
Very nice, Gil. What's your favorite Twilight Zone episode? And it doesn't have to be, I know it's an impossible question to answer, it doesn't have to be one you did a commentary on. did you do either of the Shatner episodes? Did you do...
No, but we have someone better doing the Shatner episode, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, which is where he sees the gremlin on
right,
the plane.
Right, of course. Directed by future podcast guest
exactly.
Richard Donner.
We had Richard Donner.
Oh, you got Richard Donner
one,
to
right.
do that.
So
oh, wonderful.
I better
oh,
have
perfect.
Him do it, right?
Ridiculous.
Yes. yeah.
But I would have to say...
I like the other one better. I know I'm in a minority.
The one with the fortune teller.
Nick of Time.
One I like better,
yeah,
too.
Spooky.
Well, here's the thing. The author of that, Richard Matheson... That's his favorite as well.
No kidding.
And he says, yeah, there's no crazy monsters. There's nothing, but it's just a...
Just
and,
dread.
And
just
Shatner
fear and dread.
Shatner is terrific in it.
He's great.
I mean, sometimes, you know, Shatner, like we say, has a tendency to overact and all that, but he's wonderful in that. And, you know, he's good in The Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, too.
He's good in both of them, but, yeah, I like the ones that really give you the creeps. I mean, those are... What's the one where the what is the title? Of course, Gary would know. The where the couple is in the car accident, and they don't realize they're dead.
Oh,
and they're in that town. They're in that little miniature.
Yeah, they're not dead. What has happened? Because that idea had been done 20 times already. What has happened is
I haven't seen it in ages, so I'm half remembering
girl,
it.
They always hear the giggling of a little girl
that's
in
the
this
one.
Town.
Oh, yes, that's it.
And what it is that she and her family are aliens from outer space, and it ends with, oh, now be nice with your humans. You have to be good or whatever. And they're in a little town that was created, like, you know, and they're just these little people who will be living there because these aliens scoop them up one night as pets.
What's
for
the name
children.
Of that one? That one.
Stop Over in a Quiet Town, I think
I haven't
is the name
seen
of that
in about 35 years.
There was also... A Twilight Zone, I forget that actress's name. It was like a Swedish sounding name. She used to be popular. She has a hitchhiker who's following
Inger Stevens.
Her.
Oh, Inger Stevens.
Inger Stevens, yes.
Incredibly scary
That's a
episode.
Scary one.
Yeah.
They went out on the road on that. As you'll notice, she's driving in her car. There's no phony projection screen. She's really driving, almost the way Steven Spielberg did Duel. They had a camera mounted in the car. And there's stuff. Some stuff's done in the studio, but she's really on the. And that's Going My Way. You know, in that case, she was dead. And she just hadn't been, the hitchhiker was going to escort her into the next world.
Mm-hmm.
Carnival of Souls, we're talking very much borrowed that
yes,
central idea of
and,
a girl who doesn't realize she's dead and is going through all this.
Yeah, maybe
and,
the hitchhiker.
And I remember
too.
She's at a train station and she's hysterical.
Yes.
Talking to the guy behind the counter. And the guy behind the counter, you know, brushes her off and says, okay, now sit down and breathe through your nose.
And Inger Stevens was terrific in that
she
episode.
She was.
I think that was based on a radio play or a short story that was written by the person, the writer who did Sorry, Wrong Number, which had Barbara Stanwyck
oh, yeah,
in the movie
I like that
version.
Picture.
Right, right. So obviously that writer, that one really was into women who were in scary situations.
And there were, I think, two Jack Klugman episodes.
Yeah, he did a few.
One was The Pool Player with Jonathan Winters. Mm-hmm. I forget.
Is that called Young
yes.
Man with a Horn?
Well, that's the other
that's
one.
That's the other one.
Oh, that's
the
yes.
other one.
So it's three.
Yes. Right. Yes.
But my favorite is in Praise of Pip.
Yeah.
And with a guest that we've had on the show, Billy Mummy.
Billy Mummy, yeah. Yeah, Billy Mummy. And
Oh, I like Long Distance Call.
Because he's, he's most famous for It's a Good Life.
It's a Good Life.
Where he's the little kid that wishes people into the cornfield, you know,
yes.
And every time he stares at you. He did a few. Klugman actually did even more. He even wound up doing one of the Hour episodes, Death Ship, which Richard Matheson wrote, where he's the captain of a ship, Ross Martin and another actor,
I
the two guys
that
under him.
One.
They just showed it just a couple of weeks ago on MeTV. And that's an Hour episode. You know, the Hour Twilight Zone, they only did one season.
We had in here Joyce Van Patten, who's on one of those Hour episodes.
Yes.
She's on The Voyage of the Queen Anne.
With all the old people.
Wonderful, with Wilfred Hyde White.
She's also in a classic Outer Limits, a feasibility study where they lift up six city blocks and they're on another planet. And ultimately the people sacrifice themselves so that all of Earth is spared this fate. That was a really wonderful episode.
And on Twilight Zone, there was Robert Redford, Charles Bronson. What's his name? Ted Knight. In a non-speaking role.
Oh, everybody turned up.
Actually, he turns up first in an early episode called The Lonely with Jack Warden.
Yes.
As a criminal who is in isolation on another asteroid or whatever it was.
And they give him a female robot.
Right. And Ted Knight is, I keep saying Ted Baxter. Ted Knight. Is one of the irritable crewmen who's these three guys, and he's like, Corey, it's time we leave now, and so he did his thing on that.
Part of the fun of watching those Outer Limits and those Twilight Zones are seeing those actors turn up. Duvall turns up with Barbara Barry.
That's right. That's in the museum.
Yes. Right, with the little dolls.
That's another one of the Hour episodes of the Twilight Zone.
That's a great
one. And he's in some classic Outer Limits as well.
Yes.
He's in The Chameleon, again, being turned into an alien to infiltrate. And James Cameron borrowed that for the big last science fiction film he did, the Avatar.
The Avatar.
A person is turned into an alien.
So you're basically saying James Cameron is a fucking thief.
I don't want to say that. No.
Gary Girardi didn't say it. Gabby Girardi.
There you go. Gabby Girardi. Everybody knows this by now. It's a sort of like an old story but he, like us, loved these shows.
Of course.
And
the things that inspire you,
you wind up, even Pumpkinhead, which is the again, I grew up loving The Creature from the Black Lagoon, so to be able to create my own head-to-toe rubber monster with claws, what a thrill.
I remember an article was written about, that was praising The X-Files, and this writer goes, it's such an improvement over those terrible Twilight Zone. And the creator of the X-Files said,
Chris Carter,
I'm flattered that you like the show, but there could not have been an X-Files if there hadn't been a Twilight Zone.
Exactly.
Nice.
He had a lot of research because we did a ton of X-Files cards and I used to hang around with them. And no, he loved all this stuff. And what's also directly connected to that, the Invaders series with Roy Thinnes.
Sure.
Oh, yes.
We had Larry Cohen here.
Yes. It was a great broadcast.
I met Roy Thinnes, and I remember I said, you were in that thing, because I didn't remember the title. And I said, where you're like an alien, and I think the hands, the way you could tell, is
the pinkies
is
a little flaky,
and,
right?
And he was looking at me like, how the fuck do you know this? He goes, because he didn't remember.
You know what happens? A lot of these guys, they go on with their lives.
It's a job.
And they forget that there's these crazy fans who know everything about this stuff.
Like us.
The other thing that was a heavy influence for Chris Carter was Kolchak the Night Stalker. As a matter of fact,
very much.
I think McGavin wound up going on the
Dan Curtis
character on the show.
Yeah.
But again, the whole idea of trying to do a show about people who investigate the occult. Universal had been trying to do that for years and years. They were famous for their horror movies, even their horror television. And Alfred Hitchcock actually produced a pilot called Dark Intruder. It was released in the theaters with Leslie Nielsen as a demon investigator. And they released it in the theaters because it was too scary for television. So that whole idea of a guy who investigates the occult was a key thing.
One time, I was at the Friars Club. And it was like up in that room, like by the steam room. And I saw Darren
McGavin
there in a bathrobe, sitting back, and he had the remote control. And he asked me if I could change the channels on it because he couldn't. And I wasn't able to figure out. And to this day, I feel bad that I couldn't help out.
You couldn't figure out something technical.
Yeah.
Shocking story. I thought you were going to save the day. As we run out of time, Gary, let's talk quickly about your these books you did for IDW. The top 100 horror films and top 100 sci-fi movies. And we will do another future show with you about these books.
Oh, great.
But
great.
I was reading your selection and your countdown in the horror books to Gilbert on the phone. And quickly, make a case, because we are not particularly Hammer fans.
No. Uh-huh.
But make a case for the horror of Dracula as the number one horror movie of all time.
Yeah, it is to me the perfect horror movie. And I'm a huge fan of the classic Universals. Don't get me wrong. Lugosi was brilliant. There's only one Lugosi, okay? You can't go near. But Horror of Dracula, that was lightning in a bottle. And it's not only considered one of the greatest horror movies, if not the greatest, it's actually considered one of the great British films, period. Because it really, unlike the one from Universal, it really was set in Victorian times. And they really played up the idea that it was the dream, lust, wish of the women, the repressed women of that time. And Lee played it perfectly. That movie is excellent. So like I say, there's a lot of people out there who really
Well, it's gorgeous
consider,
to look at.
Yes.
For sure.
And it was Hammer. It was the greatest Hammer horror film ever made. Christopher Lee wound up doing Dracula, playing Dracula. In a lot of the sequels, they're okay, they're entertaining, but Horror of Dracula is Hammer at its best.
I heard somebody refer to Lee and Cushing on a website where you were being interviewed as the what did they say?
Uh-oh.
They were the Martin and Lewis of
yes.
the British horror.
I said,
does that make Michael Goff Sammy Petrillo? But I just got
that's a perfect connection.
I just got such a kick out of that. But this book is wonderful, and I'm going to show Gilbert. You'll get him a copy, I'm sure. Everything is in here, Gilbert. All your favorites. Mystery of the Wax Museum, Island of Lost Souls.
Oh, well, these are all the essentials.
Yeah, Dr. Fives movies, which we love and have talked about. And we ran out of time, but we could do a million shows with you.
I know. There are so many other things that we didn't get to.
Yeah.
But we can do some more.
Gilbert,
at some point.
Give him a little bit of your Vincent Price impression, because I don't think think Gary's been treated to this.
In the movie Laura, he says something about music, and like the detective says, "Oh, so you know a lot about music?" And he goes, "I don't know a lot about anything, but I know a little about practically everything."
You caught his soul, my friend.
Next time you come back, you get his Peter Lorre.
I'm going to hold you to that.
We're withholding. So give us all the plugs. The Blu-rays are out of Outer Limits. You did commentary.
Rex Harrison was an anti-Semite, right?
Now let's get to the real juicy stuff.
Yeah.
You held that over from that Dr. Doolittle episode.
Anthony
I don't know if Edward Mulhare is continuing
Edward
as
Edward Mulhare
as
became an anti-Semite
right?
just to be like Rex Harrison.
Good figure. I don't know.
Tell us about the books, the Topps books, these books.
And whatever. Okay. The Top 100 series, I have my own publishing company called Fantastic Press. I'm partnered with IDW, which is, I don't know if they're the number three or four biggest comic book companies. And the fellow who's the president of that grew up loving a lot of fantastic television a lot. So he said, "God, if you could just do books like that."
They're great.
So I
came up with this gimmick. Researched.
And not only that, it's like they're giant trading cards.
Yeah.
Because
I
designed the books the way I would design the cards. So that there is, it's kind of like, this is everything about me because it's got some of Topps in me. It's got fantastic television in me.
They're wonderful.
It's all kind of in there. And we did four of them, top 100 horror movies, top 100 sci-fi movies.
Comic book movies.
Top 100 fantasy movies and top 100 comic book movies.
They're all great.
Which sort of ends the series.
We'll plug them on social media.
There you go.
And those Topps books, too, are wonderful. Abrams did a great job with them.
Yep, and they still want to do more. I'm also trying to put together a Making Dinosaurs Attack book, probably not for Abrams. They were sort of interested, but not interested. They're sort of kind of cooling on some of this. But I have other companies who want to do that, which is great because I have every last bit of drawings and everything on how that set was.
We barely
created.
Got into now, Dinosaurs what, Attack, so next
what
time.
What did you think of the movie Mars Attacks?
We had a second here, I could tell you. I had gotten the rights to the movie rights to Mars Attacks after I did Pumpkinhead with my partner. We wanted to set up a movie, and we wrote a script that was serious because the way the cars affected us when it was total seriosity, total terror. Okay. But
they took a different approach.
We went around in the 90s, even saw James Cameron. We saw everybody with it, and certainly didn't say what I thought about these Outer Limits things, but we won't get into that. And what we were told, I can remember what Paramount told us, well, we don't think War of the Worlds is coming back. And I'm going, a few years later, you've got War of the Worlds Invasion from Space movies
sure,
coming out of your
all.
Ears.
They did them all.
And in the interim, Tim Burton got the movie rights to do Mars Attacks and Dinosaurs Attacks. And he wanted to do Dinosaurs Attacks first. And then he got nervous because of Jurassic Park.
I see.
So he went over to do Mars Attacks, not even realizing that Independence Day was kind of happening that same year, too. So he bumped into that as well. It is not the way we would have done it. He had just done the Ed Wood movie.
Yeah.
And I think he thought of Mars Attacks as his Plan 9 from outer space to have fun with
it. Was camp.
Yeah.
It has its moments.
You know, the original, a perfect example of the difference in the original trading card set, one of the most famous cards is Destroying a Dog, which has a dog with an alien turning his death ray on the dog. And the dog is just flitting away in this horrific image with the owner, the little boy going, no, no, no. Freak the hell out of us. Killing soldiers is one thing, but killing your pet?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. And when it was done in the movie, in the Jack Nicholson, it was done as a throwaway gag. It was the president's dog or something.
The movie's very silly, but has some nice moments.
I mean, it got its own cult following, and it's funny in a way, but I think of it like the Batman series from the 60s, which didn't really understand how to deal with the dark, serious aspect. It just made fun of it. And that's kind of what Tim Burton did with Mars Attacks.
Different animal.
Yeah.
Where do you go? Shall we wrap?
Okay.
This man has a life to get back to, too.
This has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre. And it's not Amazing Colossal Podcast. It's Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Obsessions. And we've had on the show Gary Girondi.
No!
Girondi!
You put the G in.
Well, I'm getting close.
You are getting closer.
If you come on the show about 70 more times, well, I'll be able to pronounce your name.
The episode we do in 2027, he'll get your first name, not yourself. Gary, this was a treat for us.
Hey,
thank you so much. Gary Girondi, and we'll have you back sometime.
It was a real thrill for me, and I got to say, I mean, I feel like I'm with old pals. Well, I am with a guy that I used to know ages ago, but we're obviously cut from the same disease.
You're a monster kid. We'll do more. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Colossal Obsessions.